Okay. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice workshop. So today I'd like to talk about or give you an overview of the work that has been done during the last years on the use of fine structure lines to trace the star formation rate and ISM conditions in galaxies. Among other things, I'll present some work that I've been doing with people in Saclay and in Heidelberg, and this talk is also with inputs from people from the Dwarf Galaxy Survey and Kingfish teams. So a short outline, my talk is split up in two parts. First, I'll talk about how we can use fine structure lines to trace the star formation rate, why we would do it, whether there's a best star formation rate indicator among these lines, and whether there's any trend with metallicity or galaxy type. In the second part, I'll briefly talk about how we can use these fine structure lines to trace the ISM conditions in galaxies. So in the first place, why do we want to use these fire and fret lines to trace the star formation rate? Well, I think it's mostly at high redshift. If we want to determine a star formation rate there, it's more easy to just simply observe one single line rather than getting several continuum band observations in the infrared or UV observations. So it's more easy to just observe C+, O1, or O3. And those lines are typically also very bright in star-forming galaxies, so we should be able to trace them and detect them also at high redshift. And also with ALMA, as you can see, we can observe the C+ line in these several bands out to very high redshifts. But as we've seen before, if we want to be able to interpret the C+ emission and the emission of other lines, we need to calibrate these lines in the nearby universe and understand how we can translate their emission to a certain star formation rate. So in my talk today, I'm going to focus on these three lines. And these three lines actually come from very different regions in the ISM. So what you can see here is a line emission from 30 Doradus in the LMC. And as you can see, the C+, O1, and O3 line emission is really coming from very different regions within this region in a galaxy. So the O1, the O3 line corresponds to typically very highly ionized gas. So you really need an ionization potential of 35 electron volts to create O3. So with O3, we're really tracing a part in the galaxy that is highly ionized. And due to the relatively low critical density, we trace more low density gas. On the other hand, the C+ and O1 lines will mainly trace PDR regions. The O1 line will trace warm or dense PDRs, while for the C+ line, the origin of the C+ line is more ambiguous. It has an ionization potential that is lower than hydrogen, so it can come from PDRs, but it can also come from H2 regions or more diffuse ionized clouds in galaxies. So this makes it more tricky. So to quickly sum up, before we start having a look at results, could these tracers be good star formation rate tracers? Well, C+ is the most obvious one to use simply because it's so bright. It can account for up to 1% of the total infrared emission of a galaxy. But of course, we have to deal with C+ line deficits and ambiguous origin of the C+ line. The O1 line is often the second brightest line. But it can be affected because its emission is coming from deeper within the cloud. It can be affected by optical depth effects and self-absorption. And it might be excited by shocks as well. Then on the other hand, the O3 line is really limited to highly ionized gas and relatively low density gas. But we've seen in low metallicity galaxies in the nearby universe that it's actually one of the brightest lines there. So just as a background, why do we think that far infrared line emission is related to star formation rate? Well, if we relate star formation to gas heating, and we assume that there's a thermal equilibrium, that the gas heating and gas cooling is in balance, then we should be able to trace star formation rate by just looking at the dominant gas cooling lines. And this is, of course, I need to emphasize that this is under the assumption that the photoelectric effect will mostly dominate the gas heating in galaxies. So just I briefly want to walk you through what has been done in the literature before. So the first attempt to try to calibrate the C+ line as a star formation rate tracer was done by Alessandro Boselli in 2002. So he correlates the C+ luminosity with H-alpha luminosity, which traces the star formation rate. And as you can see, this first calibration is not really very promising. There's a lot of dispersion there. And they can mainly conclude from this study that C plus is actually a poor star formation rate tracer. And they attribute the dispersion due to the fact that C plus is actually coming from different ISM phases within a galaxy. In 2011, we made an attempt ourselves as well. So we gathered all of the C plus data from ISO, only for unresolved sources with respect to the ISO 75 arc second beam. And we used far UV and 24 micron as our reference star formation rate tracer. And as you can see, the trend that we derive is a lot better. We get a very nice correlation, and the trend that we derive is close to linear. But this is, of course, only for normal star-forming galaxies, of which we might expect them to behave more normally. Then in 2002, 1 year later, Sargent did a study to see whether C plus can be a good star formation rate indicator also in starburst galaxies. And as you can see, they find a quite nice trend. They do find a C plus deficit, mostly in AGNs. So they conclude that C plus can be a reliable star formation rate tracer in starburst, but not in AGNs. They did a follow-up study. So here you have the ratio of C plus over the star formation rate as traced by a combination of neon lines. And on the horizontal axis, you have the equivalent width of the PAO feature at 6.2 micron, which allows to distinguish between starburst, composite, and AGNs. And you can clearly see that if you would estimate the star formation rate from C+, you would underestimate the star formation rate in AGN due to this C+ deficit. In this paper, they purely attribute the C+ deficit that they observe to the presence of the AGN, but we'll see later on that people have come up with other arguments as well. Then a study that we did in 2014 was to see what the effect of metallicity and galaxy type is. So to study the effect of metallicity, we had a look at the 50 low metallicity dwarf galaxies that were observed with Herschel as part of the dwarf galaxy survey. And at that time, we also gathered all of the available literature data for different types of galaxies, so dwarf galaxies, starbursts, AGNs, Eulergs, but also high redshift galaxies, to see whether we see any trend with galaxy type. So the dwarf galaxy survey, so all of the galaxies, 50 galaxies, are shown here as a function of metallicity and distance. So we go out or down to 1/5 of solar metallicity, so really low. And we also have several galaxies really very nearby, which allows a spatially resolved study of these galaxies. So before I show you any results, I think it's interesting to first think, what could be the effect of metallicity on the ISM in galaxies? Well, the most obvious thing is that, of course, we will have less dust in our galaxies if the fraction of metals is lower. So this will give us a longer free path length. And what we will get is that we get a lot of photodissociation of CO, and the structure of the cloud will completely change. So we're left with a very small CO core, and it's surrounded by a larger C plus emitting zone. So that is one effect that could maybe cause the C plus emission to be higher at low metallicity. On the other hand, what people have observed as well is that the grain properties really are completely different going to lower metallicity. So here you can compare the SED of a typical dwarf galaxy with the SED of the Milky Way, and as you can see, it's completely different. Also, studying the different grain populations that are present, we see that there's typically a very low abundance of PIHs once we go to very low metallicity. But on the other hand, there's also a very high abundance of very small grains. So we get fragmentation of these larger grains, which leaves it with a lot of very small grains. And knowing that both PIHs and very small grains dominate the photoelectric effect, it's not clear what the influence will be on the efficiency of the photoelectric effect and on the gas heating. Time to show you some results now, if you're still awake. So we did a spatially resolved and a global study of the dwarf galaxies. We had six nearby dwarf galaxies that we could study on spatially resolved scales. And the plots that you can see here show you the surface density of the star formation rate as a function of surface density of C plus emission O1 emission and O3 emission, and all of the different galaxies have been indicated with different colors and different symbols. And the first thing that you can notice is that there's actually an offset between the different galaxies. So this tells us that the ISM structure is very different in those galaxies, or the heat and cooling balance is very different. So this might indicate us that in these different galaxies, the heating mechanisms are different, or that maybe the dominant line that is cooling the ISM is different in those different galaxies. Another thing that we can notice is that actually the dispersion in the star formation rate C plus relation, looking at these low metallicity galaxies, is higher. The best trend that we find is actually for the O1 line. So it seems that the O1 line, which traces warm or dense PDRs, is actually a better star formation rate indicator. Then we did the same analysis now on global scales, and this shows you the linear trend. The dashed line here shows you the linear trend that we found in 2011 for normal star-forming galaxies. And the data points here show you where the global low metallicity galaxies fall on the C plus star formation rate relation. So you see that for a given star formation rate, the C plus emission in those low metallicity dwarf galaxies is actually lower. It seems that we have you can't call it a C plus deficit because the star formation rate was traced by a combination of far UV and 24 micron, but it does seem that using C plus, we would underestimate the star formation rate. And again, on global scales, we seem to find that the O1 line is the best tracer. Now, we were interested to study a little bit more into detail why C plus is a poor star formation rate indicator at low metallicity, and we went to have a look at a few correlations. So on the vertical axis here, you always see the dispersion, which shows you the residual between the star formation rate traced by our reference tracers far UV and 24 micron, and the star formation rate traced by C plus. And what you see in both cases on global and resolve scales is that we get a correlation with infrared color and dust temperature. So this indicates us when we go to warmer infrared colors that C plus would, if we would calculate the star formation rate from C plus, we would underestimate the star formation rate. And there are several possible explanations that we come up with. First of all, it could be that when we go to lower metallicity, we get a lower photoelectric efficiency simply because the PIH abundance drops. We could also get an increase of the grain charging, which additionally could lower the photoelectric effect. Or on the other hand, as we've seen, there's a lot of O3 line emission, so it indicates that there is a lot of hard radiation present. So it might be that carbon is not locked in C+, but in C++. But based on the data that we have at hand right now, it's not possible to disentangle between those different scenarios. Another thing that we observed is when we look again at the dispersion, is that we actually find a trend with ISM structure. So we've used the ratio of O1 over C+ plus O1 as a tracer or a proxy of warm or dense PDRs. And we see that, again, C+ is not a good star formation rate tracer once we go to regions or galaxies where we're dominated by warm or dense PDRs. So this seems to indicate us that in those galaxies, O1 would be a better star formation rate tracer. So most of the gas in PDRs is more in warm, dense phases, and that's why C+ is contributing less to the cooling there. A similar trend is observed when we look at a proxy of the ionized gas fraction. So we look at the ratio of O3 over C+ plus O1. And again, we see a trend. There's quite some dispersion here, but we do think that this trend shows us that in some low metallicity galaxies, we're really dominated by a very diffuse, highly ionized gas phase. And so most of the cooling is actually happening in this diffuse, ionized gas phase by the O3 line. So that's why in those galaxies, C+ is a less good star formation rate tracer. What we also find, and it does make sense if we follow the interpretation that we assume that the gas heating and cooling is in balance. In the end, if we combine C plus O1 and the O3 line emission on, for the resolved galaxies here, we see that the trend is actually a lot better. So there's a significant reduction of scatter in our star formation rate line relation. So this actually confirms what we thought before, is that when we trace the main cooling lines in galaxies, we should be able to trace the star formation rate. We did this also on a literature sample of galaxies. So we gathered 530 galaxies with C+ detections, which were published in the literature. We had 150 O1 line detections and 102 O3 line detections. So the different galaxy types here are indicated with different colors, and the plots here show you the dispersion. So again, you see star formation rate as a function of C+, O1, and O3. And the first thing that you can notice are these orange blobs that are actually completely offset from our best fitting trend. And these orange blobs correspond to the ULERGs. So it seems that these ULERGs clearly have a line deficit, which makes them offset from the normal star formation rate Fahrenfeld line relations. On the other hand, we again see if we compare C+ for the dwarf galaxies indicated in red, that they're actually also on the low end. So they really show low C+ emission for a given star formation rate. If we look at the O3 line, we see that the dispersion is very high, and you really clearly see the offset here between the different galaxy types. So it seems here, you can clearly see it, it's only in the dwarf galaxies that we see a very bright O3 line emission, while in other galaxies, the O3 line emission is a lot weaker. So this would be something interesting to look at high redshift, whether indeed we get a very bright O3 line emission there as well. Okay, this should have been a table. But so what we did in our paper in the end is make star formation rate calibrations for every different galaxy type, because I think that's, in the end, the way forward, because it's clear from here that for the different galaxy types, we really need different star formation rate recipes. So I would advise you, if you know the galaxy type, or you know whether it's a ULERG or not, to use these different calibrations. Now with kingfish, they did a similar study as well. They don't cover such a wide metallicity range, but they do cover a very nice sample of galaxies with different morphologies. So what Rodrigo Hera Camut did here is they looked at the star formation rate's surface density as traced by 24 micron as a function of star formation, as a function of surface density of C+. And as you can see, they find a very nice trend on resolved scales for these kingfish galaxies. And when they overplot on the left here all of the galaxy centers, they see that there is an offset. So it seems that galaxy centers don't follow the same C+ star formation rate trend. What they also did is, they similarly as our study, looked at residuals, and they didn't find a trend with PIH abundance, which shows us that the dispersion that we see in this trend is actually not driven by a drop in the PIH abundance, which would then result in a lower photoelectric efficiency. However, they do find a trend with infrared color, and what they did is they constructed a star formation rate relation based on C+, but as a secondary parameter, they included the infrared color. So as you can see here, this is the trend before he used infrared color as a secondary parameter, while here it does include the infrared color correction. And what they find is that actually their relation also works for non-AGN ULERGs. So as you can see here, they nicely fall. You have five orders of magnitude, all of these galaxies nicely fall on the star formation rate C+ relation when you take into account this infrared color correction. I briefly also want to show these results where they looked at the C+ emission in our own Milky Way. I think these observations are very nice. So with Herschel Hi-Fi, they observed C+ along 500 sight lines in the Milky Way. And by looking at correlations on spatial scales, but also by comparing velocity profiles of C+, H1, 12CO, and the optically thin 13CO, they can constrain the C+ contribution in different ISM phases. So what they find here, the gray shaded regions, shows you that most of the C plus emission is actually coming from galactocentric radii between 4 and about 11 kiloparsec, while the H1 distribution is a lot more extended. And in blue, you also see the 12 CO line distribution. So it seems that the C plus emission in our own Milky Way is better tracing the distribution of emission of 12 CO. In the end, if you put this into numbers, they find a 47% contribution from PDRs, 28% of CO dark molecular gas, 21% of cold atomic gas, and about 7% only of ionized gas. And if you look at the trend with galactocentric radii, so this so shows you where you have the CO emission, and this in red shows you how you can trace the CO dark gas fraction in our own Milky Way with C+. So it seems that this fraction of CO dark gas is really increasing with galactocentric radius. Now, what they also did is they tried to correlate C+ with star formation rate, and this shows you a relation over several orders of magnitude for normal galaxies, even galactic PDRs, the typical linear relation that we find in green. And in red, you have the data points from the Milky Way on there. So they seem to nicely fall on there. But then what they are able to do as well, since they're able to separate the C plus emission from those different ISM phases, they can actually construct C plus star formation rate relations for these different ISM phases. So you have the trends in red for dense PDRs, in black for the ionized gas phase, in blue for the cold neutral medium, and in black for the CO dark molecular gas. And what you see is that the trend in these different ISM phases is every time very different from the linear slope that we find if we just look at global galaxies or when we combine these different ISM phases. So it seems that the global star formation rate C plus relation that we find is actually a result from combining the C plus cooling in those different ISM phases. And I'm not going to spend too much time here because it has been covered yesterday and in the talk before as well, but we've seen several galaxies at high redshift that are actually completely offset from the star formation rate C plus relation. So that's why I think it will be interesting to study galaxies in the nearby universe with very low metallicities. We've also seen that they start to be offset so that they show a very low C plus emission for a given level of star formation rate. So metallicities definitely plays a role. And I think by combining high redshift observations with observations in the nearby universe of low metallicity galaxies, we should be able to get a better constraint on this. So this is another galaxy which clearly shows the offset. And this was shown yesterday as well. The SED is actually very similar to the SEDs that we observe in low metallicity dwarf galaxies in the universe, which again, is additional evidence that these both sources might be very similar. So conclusions of the first part, I've shown you that C plus is actually a poor star formation rate tracer at low metallicity. This can be first of all explained by the fact that the ISM structure is completely different. So going to lower metallicity due to the hard radiation and the more leaky ISM structure, we get a volume that actually is dominated by very highly ionized gas of low density. So we have a lot of cooling through the O3 line, and the C plus line is cooling less of the ISM. We also shown the effect of galaxy type, so we really need separate calibration, especially for Eulerks per galaxy type. And actually the best star formation rate indicator seems to be the O1 line. And C plus can be used as well, but then we need the galaxy specific or the infrared color correction based star formation rate relations. Now in the second part, I quickly want to give you an overview of the work that has been done on C plus line deficits and other line deficits, and present you some multi-phase ISM modeling results and show you that this is probably the way forward to understand what's going on better. So for people not familiar with the C plus deficit, this is actually the drop that we get in the C plus FIR ratio when we go to higher FIR luminosity. So you can clearly see this was first identified by Malhotra in 2001, that we clearly see a drop here when we go to higher Fahrenheit luminosities. And it seems that the C plus FIR ratio correlates with infrared color. And this is an updated plot published by Gordon Stacey, also including now high redshift galaxies. So you still see the normal star forming galaxies here. We clearly see a deficit in the local Eulers. And when we go to high redshift, there's actually a huge dispersion. So some of the galaxies seem to fall on the same trend as the normal star forming galaxies, but a lot of other galaxies show a clear deficit. So there's something that needs to be better understood there, where the spread comes from. People have come up with several explanations for this C plus deficit, either self-absorption of the C plus line emission, saturation of C plus line flux, charging of dust grains, which could lead to a drop in the photoelectric efficiency, a high dust to gas opacity, or possibly also an AGN contribution. And I'll give you a short overview of what people have done based on Herschel data. So this shows you the results of the Herschel Shining program, which observed a huge variety of different galaxy types, so local starbursts, Seyferts, low metallicity galaxies, but also Eulers, both at low and high redshift. And so this is the C plus deficit plot that they obtained. There's quite some scatter, as you can see as well, especially at high redshift. But when they plot the same C plus FIR ratio as a function of the ratio of far infrared luminosity over molecular hydrogen mass, they actually see a much better correlation. There's a lot less scatter in this trend, and this can actually be seen as a proxy of star formation efficiency. What they also see is that this line deficit is not only constrained to C+, but it is also seen in O1 lines and even in ionized gas tracers such as O3 and nitrogen 2, as you can see here and here. So the explanation that they need to come up with should not only work for PDR regions, but also for more ionized gas regions. And by running some H2 region and PDR models, they actually find that the line deficit occurs at a very high ionization parameter. So the explanation that they come up with is that the deficit occurs in very dusty H2 regions, where a lot of the emission from young stars is first absorbed by the dust, and it cannot longer reach the gas where it will contribute to the gas heating. So that's why we see this drop in the emission of these cooling lines, both in PDRs but also in H2 regions. Then this was also confirmed later on by the Herschel GOALS survey. So they observed a sample of 202 LURCs and EULURCs. So you see in gray the normal star forming galaxies, and their sample clearly most of those galaxies show a clear deficit. So they see again the correlation with infrared color as well. But in addition, they also see a correlation with mid-infrared surface density, as well as with a 9.7 micron silicate absorption feature. So they again attribute this trend to the fact that you get the line deficit in more warm, compact starbursts where you have a higher dust opacity. As well, in a follow-up paper by Diaz Santos, they can actually separate the more extended emission from the nuclei. So in gray, you see the nuclei, and you see that the deficit is actually largest in the nuclei of these galaxies. And as a possible explanation, it was invoked that in the nuclei of galaxies, you can have an increased X-ray flux, which actually pumps up or highly ionizes the C+, so you won't find carbon in C+, but you will find it in higher ionization. I will very, very quickly maybe just show you this, because I think it is... Can I quickly show... It will be very quick. So what we started doing for the Dwarf Galaxy Survey is started doing multi-phase ISM modeling. And the interesting thing, so here you see the C+ over TIR ratio as a function of total infrared luminosity. You clearly see, this shows you the ULUX and normal galaxies, and the colored symbols shows you the low metallicity galaxies color-coded by metallicity. And what you see, similarly to what was found by the Kingfish team, is actually when you go to lower metallicity, the C+ over TIR ratio is actually higher compared to the normal galaxies and ULUX. Especially the O3 line emission, as I showed you before, is very, very bright in those low metallicity galaxies, up to an order of magnitude higher. Doing multi-phase ISM modeling, we try to explain where this is coming from. What we find is that at low metallicity, this is mostly driven by a harder radiation fields and a dilution of the UV. So I'll just leave up my conclusions.
All right, so I wanted to put together something from the second brief part of your talk and the first part. And so something you didn't mention, but it seems to me, if you are thinking about ULUR, it has to be important, is the molecular phase. Why can't you just, so why can't the C2 deficit be because the carbon's all CO? I mean, we know in, if you go look at, say, ARP220, mm-hmm. right, 95% of the carbon atoms aren't atomic carbon, they're CO. So why doesn't that solve the problem?
I don't think people have tried that yet, no.
Okay.
But you should have an I mean, that would mean that if you have your cloud structure, that the C+ emitting zone would be smaller, right? So you have a quicker transition to more dense shielded regions.
Which is exactly right. If the column density, mm-hmm. in ARP220 is, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 solar masses per square parsec, right?
All you right. It's, not, it's less, not a uniform medium.
No, I understand. Nonetheless, mm-hmm. the average density column density are much higher.
I have lots of surfaces.
Okay. I don't see why not. I mean, we know by mass it's dominated by CO.
But that's deeper. I mean, that's deeper within the cloud, but at lower densities, there's not much that changes, right? Or you more quickly make the transition to a more dense medium and you skip the C+ emitting.
So, yeah, I mean, the picture I have is just the mean density is higher. That is certainly true. So if the depth of that and the mean column density is higher, right? So, yes, there are C+ emitting zones, but by mass or by volume or by whatever, they're a much smaller fraction of the total mass of the ISM in ARP220 than they are in the Milky Way, right? I mean, you know the typical hydrogen atom in ARP220 is in a molecule, right? It's not an atom. So why is it any different with carbon atoms than hydrogen atoms? Well, I mean,
the question is where is the FIR coming from? Well, the FIR is coming from the surfaces where the dust has absorbed the radiation, which is also producing the C+. So I don't think you can solve it that way by just assuming that everything is molecular. You can just, you're going to have lots of surfaces, simply.
Well, so. There are smaller fractions of
all that, so Coffee. Okay. This goes to Coffee.
Anyway, I have opinions about that. I should talk to Mark. But so I was going back on the question of the what is happening at low metallicities. Mm-hmm. No? And something has to be doing the cooling of the neutral medium. No, so the fact that the O3 is pumped up, I don't know if it isn't well understood or not. But I haven't seen the physical explanation why we get brighter O3 emission. But in any case, that is associated with ionized gas. No?
Yeah, that's simply, so it's a combination of the hard, I'll just first reply to that. It's just a combination of the hard radiation field that you get and a very leaky ISM structure, so there's a lot more radiation that is able to escape, travels out to further distances, so you really get a volume that is dominated by this highly ionized, diffuse medium. So you have radiation escaping from your star-forming regions due to the low metallicity, that's easier, and you have this is combined with the harder radiation you had you have at low metallicity.
Okay, but that will give you more, you know, maybe more or three atoms to lay around, etc. So I guess the argument would be that that's the reason for the O3 brightness. But what I was trying to say is that the you still have to cool the neutral medium in some way, no? So if you yeah, so you do it through C plus and oxygen one. So you know that still has to reflect the cooling of the neutral medium. So I don't know. Is the O1 pump, is the one, you know, doing more of the cooling relative to the C plus? That is it normally in normal metallicity environments or not?
So what we see is that there's actually not a very nice correlation with metallicity. It really depends on from galaxy to galaxy and ISM structure. It's also just at one point in time you're looking at those galaxies. And as I said before, those galaxies are a bit biased by the fact that they really had a very recent burst of star formation. So you're just looking at a certain point in time. And part of the cooling is done by C+, but there's an additional part in galaxies where you do see at low metallicity that the fraction of warm dense PDRs is higher, so you have more O1 emission. But again, we need to be careful because it has been shown at lower metallicity that you get these pseudo PDRs where you have soft X-rays actually causing the gas heating, and the O1 emission that you see there is not really related to star formation. So it's...
Yeah, okay, fine, but...
And even, yeah, another thing that may be better response to your question is that they do see, you do see if you do these models comparing normal high metallicity galaxies compared to low metallicity galaxies, is that the volume that is traced by this highly ionized low density gas is a lot larger compared to the PDRs. So you get smaller PDRs in those low metallicity galaxies, and they're often denser. But that's why probably the fraction of the ISM that is dominated by these warm dense PDRs or normal PDRs is just lower, and that's why probably the C+ emission is going down.
I mean, the only thing that I'm trying to argue is that there is a fundamental balance that has to be kept somehow. Mm-hmm. No? So whatever goes in has to come out in some way. So I'm trying to understand what the accounting of the that comes out is, because if it is true that the...
The nice thing that I think shows this a little bit...
Yeah, so you were showing that.
When
that
we indeed combine the different... I mean, it's just because the ISM structure is so different in those different galaxies, and in the end, when we add up the different main coolants in those galaxies, you do see that the trend is better.
Okay, but that is fundamentally dominated by the O3, from what you were saying, I would imagine. So that's the part that I'm trying to understand. But anyway, I should let it out.
It's not the brightest line in all dwarfs, but it's often very bright and definitely an order of magnitude brighter than normal star-forming galaxies. But that's simply because it's such a, it's tracing low-density gas, but it needs to be highly ionized. And as soon as you have more metals, there will be way less radiation escaping from your star-forming region. So it's very difficult. If you have a dusty starburst galaxy, there will be, you won't be dominated by this phase because there won't be as much radiation escaping, creating this diffuse, highly ionized region in low metallicity galaxies.
Yeah, no, actually, I just wanted to follow on and try to comment on your point, which I think is very important. So whatever comes in has to come out. So if it is true that, as you're mentioning, is the photoelectric effect that is changing. So if I am an UV photon and I try to hit the grain, I hit the grain, I'm getting absorbed, but I don't do photoelectric effect. So I'm not hitting the gas, but yet I'm absorbed and I'm hitting the dust. So that's why you don't have carbon two emission, and maybe the energy goes out in the far infrared as dust, because you're hitting the dust without producing photoelectric effect that hits the gas. Is it a viable solution?
It could be, but as I said, I think that's something where work needs to be done yet on the grain composition at low metallicity. So I think it's very well studied already that the pIH abundance drops when you go below metallicity of 8 or so. So that's fairly well studied. But then you can also clearly see that the abundance of very small grains is often is higher due to the very turbulent ISM. You get a lot of shocks and fragmentation of larger grains. So this has been studied in a handful of galaxies or at low metallicity, where they really see this high abundance of very small grains. And then the question is, which of those grains will really dominate the photoelectric effect? So it actually could be even higher if you have very small grains dominating the photoelectric effect.
It doesn't need to be pHs. You can also with small grains.
Yeah.
I have two questions, a comment and a question. The comment is, when we talk about star formation rates, we have to actually be very careful of which time scale we mean. Do we mean O stars or B stars? Because B stars can do the C plus, can generate C plus. And so it's a question whether we mean the instantaneous star formation rate given by, O stars, or whether we mean some time-integrated star formation rate. So that's the comment. I don't know whether this distinction is always made.
It depends a lot on the reference star formation rate tracer that we use. And we use a combination of, for the low metallicity dwarfs, of 4 eV in 24 microns, so that should trace up to 100 million years old.
Yeah, but that is pretty old. That's B stars. So that's O stars. Because when you talk star formation rate, people always have in mind the one that is happening now, like the last few million years, O stars, but not B stars. So I have to be careful about.
But a lot of the reference traces, like 24 micron, is gonna trace star formation rate, more obscured star formation, up to 10 million years old. But then on the other hand, you can have a lot, especially in low metallicity dwarfs, you can have a lot of unobscured star formation. So you should trace that as well. And we've tried H alpha in those low metallicity dwarfs, but that doesn't work because their star formation rate history is very peaky. Mm. So they really have bursts of star formation. So their H alpha is a no-go.
Yeah.
So that's why we went for far UV.
Yeah, I understand.
And that traces then up to 100 million years old. But that also makes sense because stars younger than 10 million years old, they will still be embedded in their Oort cloud. So that's why we trace that using 24 micron.
As long as we're aware what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. And the question is about the oxygen one, which has two transitions, 63 microns and 145 microns. Now, 145 microns is much weaker, but maybe it's
optically
less
thin.
Optically thick. And what is the trade here? I mean, what is the critical density actually of 145? Is that, I don't know.
145, I don't know it by heart.
And
no.
And so I would like to understand the relative merits of the two lines, because one is weaker and maybe it doesn't do what we need, but on the other hand, the other one line at 63 microns is harder to interpret. So what to do?
Well, with Herschel, we mostly detected the 63 micron, and that already confined or constrained our analysis mostly to the 63 micron line. But I agree, the 145 would be better and easier to interpret. So it is weaker, but it's optically thin, or more often optically thin than the one line at 63 microns. So you're right that it would be a better tracer, but ideally we go for the brightest one. Like I showed you, C plus is really not the best tracer you can dream of, but it's just the brightest line, so people will use it. So we need to tweak it and calibrate it.
We have this problem with the Zuri Dorado Sophia observations, that 0163 microns is difficult in the first place because it's in an atmospheric window where you can't observe in the large Magellanic clouds. It's okay in the small, but not in the large. Just the redshift is unfortunate. But then the 145 is like 10 times weaker, and it takes, I don't know, 30 hours of telescope time for a small map. So,
so what to do? But in reality, the 145 line is a lot better or would be easier to interpret, but it's weaker, so people go for 63.
Last question.
Okay. Related to Hans's question, I mean, is there any dependence on the starburst age in that? I mean, you must have some information about the age of the starburst in those objects. right? Does the ratio, I mean, does that left-hand figure, right? I mean, can you interpret in terms of the starburst stage?
Here you mean?
Yes.
We haven't looked into that. That would be interesting, yes.
Yeah, I think it could actually give you an awful lot of information, particularly in terms of star formation histories, right, and the production levels of the photons, right?
And you mean then for the line emission or mostly for the...
Well, I think you're comparing two quantities, which both depend on the time after the starburst.
The problem here is that these reference star formation ray tracers are all assuming that you have a continuous star formation rate over the time scale to which these tracers are sensitive to. So basically, if you use far UV to constrain star formation rate, this assumes that you have a constant star formation rate over a time scale of 100 million years old, which is of course not true in those bursts. That's why, or in these bursty low metallicity dwarf galaxies, that's why we're not using H alpha, because there it will be even worse.
But you could use a combination of H alpha. I mean, you shouldn't go on too much, but H alpha and FUV is a time dependent determination.
Yeah, or even the way forward.
Try and interpret the difference between the levels on there in terms of the histories, right?
We haven't, because there's so many things driving the dispersion. We haven't looked at that particular component, but it would be interesting, and the best way forward is probably to really have star formation histories and based on that maybe derive average star formation rates.
It looks like it's the driving components, right? Just because other effects are likely to be dependent on galaxy position and all sorts of other things. I mean, because metallicities vary, structures vary, and so on. I mean, whereas you're getting a very systematic dependence from galaxy to galaxy, and that has to have some underlying driver that's fairly powerful.
But then
I think the point was made right a couple of times. So I suggest you guys talk on the coffee break.
Yeah.
So
it will have an effect, but I think it's not the dominant effect. Mm-hmm. But. Mm-hmm.
So let's thank the morning speakers again, and we'll reconvene at 11:05.